back of the end zone, and it is caught for a touchdown by Holmes.
Welcome back into another edition of the Fifth Down Podcast. I am your host, Mike Fiella. We have a jam-packed show for you all this evening. In First Down, I am joined by the COO of the College Football Playoff, Michael Kelly, to discuss what does the College Football Playoff mean for the sport of college football? How will this impact the different conferences and teams? And what does this mean for you, the viewer? In Second Down, I am joined by CBS Sports fantasy football writer Dave Richard to discuss how the NFL offseason has impacted draft boards, with a focus on Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski, among others. Dave and I also touch on how has the mobile quarterback shifted the focus in fantasy football. In Third Down, I am joined by former NFL referee, now officiating analyst for NBC Sports, Jim Diapolis, to discuss the rule changes in the NFL and how does that impact the players, in addition to sharing some of the favorite stories from the gridiron. So without further ado, let's hop in to First Down. Into First Down now, I am joined by the COO of the Future College Football Playoff and former Senior Associate Commissioner of the ACC, Michael Kelly. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. We brought Mr. Kelly on here to discuss the future of college football because it is a constantly changing area with the news that they are going to a college football playoff. The first question I would ask you is, how does the football playoff change the bowl season? Are there huge changes, incremental changes? Is it going to happen all at once? What is the progress and the prognosis there?
Well, the current format, of course, will remain for one upcoming season. So the BCS format is still in place for the upcoming season, and all the bowl contracts that are involved with the various conferences will continue as such as well. But for the season following that, there will be a substantial shift in how the postseason of college football is operated, primarily because of the postseason playoff that the conferences have come together to put on place. And what will happen then is that there will be a total of six bowl games that will exist, three of which will be played on December 31st, three of which will be played on January 1st. And really trying to go back to that traditional landscape of major and many bowl games being played on surrounding that New Year's holiday. And of those six games, those six bowl games will rotate every year, the hosting of the two semifinal games, in essence, that will determine who will now play in a national championship game. So the overall landscape, that'll change. There'll be kind of four teams that get a chance to play in for the national title, compared to what we've done in the past. And those other games will also be in, very significant time slots that will also feature, when they're not hosting the semifinals, will feature, very compelling matchups that we all look forward to.
The major bowls are going to alter in terms of semifinal and final games. And when they are not doing that, they will still be your traditional matchups. For instance, the Rose Bowl, if it's not a semifinal matchup, will still have a Pac-12 and a Big Ten team.
That's correct for the situation for the Rose Bowl, Sugar Bowl, and Orange Bowl. That they have all contracted with specific teams or conferences to have those traditional matchups, and they're not hosting the semifinal games. We will select next week, or rather the commissioners will select next week, who the other three bowls will be that will be in that rotation of hosting semifinals. And when they're not hosting semifinals, in their case, they will be, in essence, assigned teams by the same selection committee that also selects the top four teams to go into the playoff.
So the college football selection committee will be similar to the basketball selection committee in the sense that it'll be a panel of experts put together for the sole purpose of ranking teams to make sure that the best matchups happen and the best teams play each other to decide the winner.
In essence, there'll be some differences as it relates to the basketball committee, I'm sure, but the working concept is similar to what you described. Bottom line is that those individuals will select the four teams and again fill in the slots of whatever's remaining for those other major bowl games.
When we think of committees, we often think of the power conferences, the historical BCS conferences. What about the non-BCS conferences? There have been teams such as Northern Iowa, Hawaii a couple of years ago, Boise State. They have found their way into bowl games. Will they be represented in that committee, or is it just the power conferences?
We're still talking through what the actual representation will be, but I'm sure there'll be representation to some extent, without question, there at the table that has put this system together. We also know that the conferences have also combined to make sure that their highest rated champion will play in this new format. So they've been protected there. And quite frankly, whether they're independent, whether they're in what's described as a power conference or what have you, the selection committee evaluates all of them, and the top four teams will obviously be able to play off for the national championship.
What made this happen now? I mean, there have been many fans that have clamored for a playoff for years now. There's, of course, with every system, what lovers or supporters of the BCS, haters saying that it doesn't get the job done correctly. What made all of the commissioners and all of the forces that be come together now? Is there an event, or did it just seem like this was the time to make it happen?
Well, you know, there was always an evolution. You've seen one over the past 15 years in this format. And what this format was charged to do that we currently enjoy is that it was its only purpose was to match number one against number two. Because for many years out of the 70-plus years before that, that had only happened like 9 to 10 times. I forget exactly the amount, but it hadn't been many.
Right.
But in the last 15 years, it's been every time. And that's a great shift. And now, to your point, I don't think there's any one event, but as time has gone on and as teams and conferences have become more competitive nationwide, it has created an opportunity that to expand that field and to find a format that could meet everybody's needs was able to come together at this time.
Does this format make it more advantageous to be part of a big conference or a power conference, or can teams that are independent still thrive? I would think, I mean, I know Notre Dame is signed on to become part of the ACC, but a lot of people thought they may have a slight advantage because they're independent. But does this format even the playing field because an unbiased, objective committee to pick the best teams?
I think what this format really does is it's kind of eliminated the evaluation of whether an institution is independent or in a member of a conference as it relates to selection process. The primary reason I say that is there's no longer any automatic qualification from a conference to be in that playoff by virtue of what conference they played in. So so now schools can truly make their own evaluation as to whether there might be other reasons to be a part of a conference, you know, for their where they want to be academically supported with, or whether there's other financial ramifications of being in a conference. But as it relates to being competitive with being fairly considered for the football championship, that's kind of changed and made it much more of an even playing field.
Do we think, or do you think, I should say, that there will be an expanded playoff in the future, or is this four-team playoff a trial period in terms of seeing if it works? Is the ultimate goal to expand it, or is it just to leave it as it is, or is it just too early to tell?
It's truly too early to tell. This is a major shift. This is something that everyone's very excited to see how it plays out. But it was definitely made with a long-term concept. This was the furthest when you balance the president's and the commissioner's academic concerns, when you, in terms of a calendar, when you balance the fairness in terms of getting teams to play and upholding, remaining, keeping some of the bowl traditions alive, in addition to creating a new activity surrounding the national championship game. All those goals and objectives, you know, were kind of put into discussion for years over the stakeholders of college football, and this is really where they ended up. That was the furthest they could all agree to and be comfortable with. And as a result, this is a major shift. It'll be in place, we anticipate, for at least 12 years, and I think the people that made that decision think it'll stay in place for much longer because I think it's the right thing to do overall.
Well, Mike, you've been obviously around the college football landscape for a long time. We have seen in the recent years many, I wouldn't say necessarily scandals, but field activities that have garnered attention. What do you think the health of the college football game is? Obviously, there's high interest in terms of fans. What is the health of the game? Or are you concerned that some of these off-field incidents will stain the on-field product?
Well, I think that, to your point, college football's never been more popular. When you look at the ratings and the amount of fans that it has, and at least amongst American sports leagues, it's second only to the National Football League. It has higher ratings than all other major sports leagues in terms of their championships and everything else. So it's clear that that college football is more popular than ever. And I think a big case could be made, despite its critics, that the BCS, you know, had a significant role in doing that. And I say that because while college football has always been very popular, it has risen over the past 15 years significantly. And I would say sometimes there might have been very much just a regional focus or a very local focus on your quote-unquote team. But the BCS transferred it to a more national landscape, and now there could be someone in Pac-12 country like where you are that maybe never watched a Clemson-Georgia Tech game, but now that very well could have impact on who's in the BCS or who's ranked where and how that might impact things, people will tune into that a little bit more and vice versa. So I think that's been a big part of it. There's so many good things about college football right now that I think people are excited about. Do the commissioners and all the coaches, associations, and everything else still have things they want to improve? Without question. They talk about it all the time. There's certainly always a concern for student-athlete welfare, student-athlete safety issues as it relates to playing rules, and so forth and so on. And they'll keep working on them. It's obviously something that we want. The institutions have responsibilities. Student-athletes and coaches have responsibilities, and everyone has to keep working together to put the best overall both product and image together that we possibly can.
I think to your point, that's correct. The BCS really has made games during the regular season more interesting, more impactful, and of course increased interest. And it's also made teams, I think, schedule hard opponents. We saw Ohio State and USC play an out-of-conference schedule. We've seen recently Arizona State and Notre Dame have signed on to play a couple games together. So I think it made teams beef up their schedule in hopes of improving the way they look, their resume, to get into bowl games. You've worked for the ACC as a conference. Conference obviously has to check the well-being of all of the teams and all of the players and all the different sports. How does a conference go about acquiring new teams? As we've seen conference realignment with a unit such as the Big East fall apart and other pick them up. How does a conference go about doing that? Is that individual case basis, or is there kind of a catch-all that makes it happen?
Oh, I think it's always, every circumstance is different. Every television negotiation takes a life of its own. Every institution takes, and every conference takes the major steps to evaluate what's best for them and vice versa during something as big as a conference realignment situation. So you really can go through every one that's happened in the past, let's say, 20 years or what have you, and each one has a different reason for it and how it kind of was instigated. Many of them obviously have had to do with revenue, without question. But I would also say that can never be in the eyes of a university president, whether with his or her institutional or overall conference hat on. That should be the sole and only factor. Colleges and institutions in this country aren't there simply to make money. There's a bigger mission at hand, and they've got to take all that very seriously in terms of what they've done. And I think in every case, everyone that's done that's been involved with the decisions would maintain that they did exactly that.
I think that's a very good point. A lot of fans, people that aren't following conference realignments and college decisions every day, I think it's kind of a cop-out sometimes just to say it's a money grab. You're right, there's a lot of different factors, and what might be good for one sport or one activity might not be the best for all, so it's hard. And one or two more here with Michael Kelly. Mike, you were a president of multiple Super Bowls, and I would assume very important on getting Super Bowls to different areas. Can you walk us through some of the big picture concepts that you had to struggle or had to deal with in terms of getting Super Bowls in certain areas?
Sure. Well, as a Super Bowl host committee president, you know, I was able to have that opportunity in three different cities. And what was most fascinating about that is that while certainly the NFL has set a standard in terms of how they run an event, they know that it has to change and it's different because of the circumstances in each city. So having a chance to evolve and adapt to the, let's say, the differing infrastructures, the differing levels of public and private support in different cities, you know, always, you know, made for different challenges and made for a very different experience. But our role there was to say, look, let's garner all the resources that we can as a community to attract the game, and then make sure that we deliver everything that we promise. Because if we do that, in all likelihood, the league will come back. And I think we're taking the same approach to how we'll start bidding out these college football championship games as well. You know, we want to share this event beyond where it's been in the past. That's not to say that everyone that's hosted it before hasn't done an outstanding job, but as the great sport of college football becomes more national in scope, you know, we want to share that championship around the country and bring some new destinations to light as we celebrate that championship weekend going forward. So I think my background of being on the host committee side helps evaluate and understand the dynamic that will go on as we continue to build this event in the future.
Finally, I would be remiss to ask you, and obviously you are an outsider in the past Super Bowl that happened. There's that power outage. If you were the host committee, how do you not happen? Or do things just happen? It's a live event. Things just happen. Is there any real way to prevent something like that from happening? Or is there anything that maybe you think could have been done better?
Well, I don't really know enough of the details to make an intelligent statement on that. What I do know is obviously not only the city of New Orleans, but pretty much every city and every league, you know, takes note of that and adds it to a deeper level of checklist to do everything that can be done to overcome that. And the last I heard, obviously, there might have been some infrastructure issues or something that wasn't as big as it could have been. But again, I don't know all the details of that, but I do know that every event in America now will learn from that and do everything they can to avoid it.
That's true. You know, sometimes things happen on live TV. I was at a show in Las Vegas this past weekend. The guy's mic pack went out right in the middle. Sometimes things just happen, and you just got to keep rolling with them. Well, Mike, that's right. Mike, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. When can we find more specifics out on what the conference or the playoff picture will look like? Is there news upcoming? Is there a place where fans can get more information?
Well, sure. Well, right now we've, you know, in the system we're at bcs-football.org in terms of our website. But the exciting thing is that next week we have our annual meetings with all of our, you know, conference commissioners and key athletic directors from throughout the conferences that we'll meet, and we'll have some very important decisions made in terms of where our first national championship game will be played in the playoff format, the three new bowls that will join the other three into the mix. So a lot of news forthcoming next week at our annual meetings, which are held in Pasadena, as we always have in the past held our meetings at the home of next year's national championship game.
Well, Mike, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
You're very welcome, Mike. Have a good day.
You too. Into Second Down now, I am joined by CBS Sports fantasy analyst Dave Richard to put a bow on the fantasy football season, in addition to previewing some of the players' strategies and big moves of the offseason. Dave, how are you?
What's going on? How are you?
I'm good. Dave, thanks a lot for coming on the show. It is a hectic time, I'm sure. The first thing I'd like to get your opinion on, your take on, is this season in fantasy, just like in real football, the quarterback position has seemed to change more to a mobile quarterback. We've seen with the influx of Russell Wilson, Colin Kaepernick, even players like Andrew Luck are mobile, even though they're pocket passers. How does that affect the fantasy season and draft day?
How could you forget about RG3 in that mix? How awesome he was. Well, I'll tell you, the first thing it's done is, because there have been so many great new quarterbacks that have come on the scene, it's made the position deeper. We're at the point now where in 2013, you're going to see names like Eli Manning, Ben Roethlisberger, Joe Flacco, Andy Dalton. Those are your backup fantasy quarterbacks. And when you think about the track record for Eli Manning and how previously he was an outstanding quarterback for fantasy, and Big Ben, same thing, those are pretty awesome backup quarterbacks when you stop and think about it. But at the same time, all the quarterbacks you mentioned, none of them are in the top five or even the top six. And I would say that among those in the top five, the only one that could even be considered a rushing quarterback would be Aaron Rodgers.
Right. It's a good thing that you mentioned Robert Griffin. He had the knee injury. I'm a little skeptical that he will be back 100%. I think it's very difficult for athletes to have the Adrian Peterson-like recovery. What do you expect from Griffin, assuming he's, let's say, 80% of himself starting next season?
Mike, if he's back at 80% for week one, I think fantasy owners will be real happy with that, and they'll take that. Certainly, RG3 is he's the definition of the fantasy quarterback that you need to spend another, you know, mid-round pick, round eight, round nine, to go and pick up another backup fantasy quarterback. If you can end your draft or get through nine rounds of your draft and your two quarterbacks are RG3 and Eli Manning, I'd say you're in pretty good shape, even if RG3 isn't quite ready to go for the start of the season, because we've seen what he can do. We've seen the potential. Now, question number one, will he be ready to go for the start of the season? Nobody can answer that now. We all thought Adrian Peterson, a year ago, we all thought AP would miss the first six games of the season because he'd be on the PUP list. And in training camp last year, we thought Adrian Peterson would miss maybe a couple games. And here he was in week one doing his thing. So you can't rule out RG3. And you also can't rule out the fact that quarterbacks have come back from torn ACLs before and have been ready to go for the start of the regular season. We've seen Carson Palmer do it. We've seen Philip Rivers do it. So it wouldn't shock me to see RG3 back in week one. Now, are we going to see the RG3 that ran for 826 yards and seven touchdowns last season? I don't know about that. I don't know if he's going to be able or willing to run the football as much as he did in the past. And because of that, because of the knee injury, because of the I think he had a concussion earlier in the season. Maybe he's kind of realized that he's got to stick in that pocket a little bit more often rather than go and run all over the place. He only attempted 393 passes. And when you compare that with pretty much every other quarterback, there's only one other one that had, you know, even under 400, and that was Russell Wilson. And I think the reins could be taken off those guys, and they'll both throw a little bit more and probably run a little bit less. But I think RG3 is still a good, I think he's certainly in position to be a good bargain in fantasy drafts, and somebody who could be round seven, round eight as your first quarterback, and then you double back for a second quarterback a round or two later.
That's a very good point. Adrian Peterson won many people their fantasy leagues, getting him in the third, fourth, fifth round, because people were afraid to invest the first or second round pick, thinking he would not be there the entire season. Who are your top rated quarterbacks, and if you had the first pick in the draft, would it be a quarterback or would it be somebody else?
It would unequivocally be a running back. I'm not interested in taking a quarterback in round one. If I'm in a 10-team league, if I'm in a 12-team league, everybody's going to get a quarterback. Everybody's going to have somebody that they're going to be at least satisfied with by the end of round six or seven. And it's you can wait. You can wait for Matt Ryan in round four. Peyton Manning might fall to you round three, round four. So I'm not inclined. The number one quarterback on my board is Drew Brees. I wouldn't take him with a first-round pick because I'm going to let somebody else take him. I'll load up on at least one stud running back with my first two picks, if not with both of my first two picks, to begin the draft.
What do you think we could expect from Adrian Peterson a year out of surgery? Do you think he will be better, about the same, or will defenses figure out the Minnesota running game, they will key on him, and he will be less productive?
I don't think there's any chance he gets over 2,000 yards again. It's just, you don't see that. But then again, you don't see a running back come back from a torn
right.
knee like Adrian Peterson did. But we're eventually going to release a study. My colleague Jamie Eisenberg is spearheading it on running backs who get over 2,000 yards and what happens to them the following season. Without question, there's going to be a regression. You just can't expect a guy to get 2,000 rushing yards again. But would it be a surprise if he had 1,500 total yards and 12, 13 total touchdowns again? Of course not. And that's what you would expect from Adrian Peterson, and that's why he's still the number one running back in fantasy football. And just to make a point, he scored in a standard scoring league, non-PPR, over 16 games, 297 fantasy points.
Unbelievable.
10 yards rushing, receiving, 6 points for a touchdown. You lose two for a fumble. He fumbled the ball away twice. 297. The next highest running back, there were two, Doug Martin and Arian Foster, tied at 248. So that's almost 50 points separating AP from Doug Martin, or 500 yards. So if he comes back down to earth by 500 yards, which is what we think could possibly happen, or most definitely happen, rather, I think Adrian Peterson is still going to be a very welcome addition for fantasy owners and a guy who's worth the first overall pick.
It's hard to argue with Adrian Peterson's success, his productivity. Another running back coming into the season, he was the consensus number one pick on many people's draft boards, Arian Foster. He had a very heavy workload this season and a productive year. What can we expect from the Texan running back?
I'm a little worried about him, to be honest with you. And right now I've got him number two among my running backs for 2013. But he had a ton of work again, second year in a row. When you tack on the postseason, well over 400 carries. He's somebody you've got to watch out for breaking down, slowing down. Or if Houston is smart about it, they're going to use other running backs and kind of lighten his load, at least for the first, I don't know, maybe the first third of the season, maybe the first half of the season. And maybe he's a guy who will occasionally get over 17 touches a game instead of being locked into that amount. But the history of running backs who get a lot of work, he had 350 carries during the regular season, another 40 catches. It's not very good. And, you know, Adrian Peterson's right up there. He also got a lot of work. But I think just with Arian Foster and the amount of work that he's had, there is going to be a chance of him breaking down. So if you draft Arian Foster, a lot of people are going to do that with the second overall pick. You've got to go and spend that eighth or ninth round pick on Ben Tate, assuming Ben Tate is still in Houston by the time we get around to drafts in August and September, just so you can protect that investment and have Arian Foster's backup in case something bad happens to Foster.
That's true. The handcuff is always one of the hardest things to judge. You don't want to take the handcuff too early, but you also don't want to be the one who is stuck without the backup. You don't want to be the guy stuck without Toby Gerhardt if you have Adrian Peterson, Ben Tate, if Arian Foster. If Ben Tate is not there, who has proven he's a very good running back in this league, are you excited about a guy like Justin Forsett, or do you think Houston would have to draft somebody?
I think Justin Forsett could get the job done. I'm not sure what his contract status is and whether or not he's signed up for the Texans in 2013. I do know that Tate is entering a contract here next year. So if the Texans don't have an interest in signing him, and if they think that they can get maybe a third-round pick for him, maybe they'd entertain that and trade him away, get the extra draft pick. They could certainly use some depth on both sides of the ball. And they can go ahead and find another running back, much like they did Arian Foster through undrafted free agency. I think whoever that backup is for Arian Foster, it's a must own. And not every single running back needs to have the handcuff, because some of the handcuffs just simply aren't as good. You look at Adrian Peterson, if he's gone, let's just say he wins Powerball and he decides to retire, because, you know, we don't want to wish injury on him, and Toby Gerhardt is suddenly the guy to start the rest of the way for the Vikings, you can't expect Toby Gerhardt to do what Adrian Peterson does. But in the case of Ben Tate, I think he could come close to what Arian Foster could do. And I think the same thing goes for a situation in Seattle where Robert Turbin is the backup to Marshawn Lynch. I think Robert Turbin's a fantastic running back. I do think that Turbin could put up numbers close to what Marshawn Lynch could put up and did put up this year. But then you go to a situation like Washington, where Alfred Morris had this outstanding season. If he's gone, not only do I not think that Roy Helu or Evan Royster could do what he did, I think they'll split and take work away from each other, so it's not necessarily worth drafting Alfred Morris's handcuff compared to somebody like Lynch, somebody like Adrian Peterson, somebody like Ray Rice, who's got Bernard Pierce behind him. I think that those are the guys that definitely warrant a second running back from the team being picked.
One of the more polarizing running backs in fantasy football has been Chris Johnson. Of course, the 2,000-yard season, which coined him the name CJ2K a couple seasons ago. Then the holdout, the down season, last season, this season, not what you would expect from a guy like Chris Johnson with his raw ability and speed. What advice would you give draft owners that have or are looking to draft Chris Johnson?
On Chris Johnson, you know, here's an example of a guy who ran for over 2,000 yards, had over 350 carries in a year, and then he regressed a little bit in 2010, and then he had the contract holdout. And then he showed up late and was there for week one for the Titans in 2011. He barely had over 1,000 yards. Bounced back a little bit this year, obviously, with 1,200 yards and 6 touchdowns. But I think he's more of a number two running back, and I think fantasy owners are going to be able to take him in round two and feel a lot safer about it, compared to this year when they took him and they said, well, I hope he can bounce back. I hope he's ready to go. And the other thing that needs to happen with Chris Johnson is he needs to have an offensive coordinator that'll stick with him. He had a number of games this year where the play calling just got away, and he had 11 carries in a game, 8 carries in a game, 14 carries in a game. Those were his first three games of the season, Mike. I'm stunned that they wouldn't use him more than they did. And once he got going against Houston, he had a lot of garbage time in that game, but he had 25 carries. Typically with Chris Johnson, when he has 20 touches in a game, and this is the no-brainer statement of the podcast, once he's got those 20 touches in a game, he puts up double-digit fantasy points. It happens with regularity. I'd say maybe 70% of the time. I'd have to double-check my numbers and make sure of that. But as long as we've got an offensive coordinator in Tennessee who's going to stick with Chris Johnson and give him the work that he deserves based on what we know he can do, I think he'll be worth drafting again as a second-round pick in fantasy.
That's true. He is so explosive. The 20-carry number makes sense. Chris Johnson can score on any point in the game at any time because of his speed. Let's shift out of the backfield now, Dave. We have an NFL that is clearly a passing league. There's great young receivers everywhere. The three I'd like to key in on, Demaryius Thomas, A.J. Green, Brandon Marshall, all have quarterbacks that can deliver them the football in Peyton Manning, Andy Dalton, and Jay Cutler. I would assume Calvin Johnson would be the number one receiver because of his freakish ability. Which one of these three, and maybe even Dallas's Dez Bryant, how do they shake out in terms of 2, 3, 4, and which one of them will be the best performer next season?
Let me preface by saying that there's probably no consensus way to rank these guys second, third, fourth, and fifth behind Calvin Johnson. It's going to come down to each individual owner and how they feel about these guys. I like Demaryius Thomas second best. I think that he's an outstanding talent, much like Calvin Johnson. I think he had a couple of mistakes on the field this year that robbed fantasy owners of some points. I remember specifically he's breaking away after a catch and he's running down the field, and all of a sudden the ball kind of hits his thigh and fumbles it. And what would have been a long touchdown for him turned out to be a catch, some yardage on top of it, and then a fumble where you lose 2 fantasy points. That's no good. I think Demaryius Thomas can correct that. I think Peyton Manning as his quarterback is a very good thing. I think Eric Decker playing opposite him is also a very good thing. Defenses can't come in and load up on Demaryius Thomas because then Eric Decker is going to eat him alive. He's my second favorite wide receiver. A.J. Green's right behind him. And even though A.J. Green doesn't have that wide receiver across from him to take away coverage like Demaryius Thomas has, He's just such a complete player as a wideout. Scored in, 9 straight games, 11 total touchdowns on the season, 97 catches on the season. Clearly he's an ascending player. 164 targets says it all. I think A.J. Green is third best on the list. And I've got Brandon Marshall next. Again, a lot of targets this year, 193. He only caught 118 passes. Only 118 passes, I should say. I'm using air quotes on a podcast. That's not going to do me any good. But I think he could actually pick up more catches next year. I think Alshon Jeffrey can take the next step in his progression. I really like what the Bears offense is going to be like with Mark Trestman as the head coach, coming up with ways to use Brandon Marshall. And I've taken a look at Trestman's history as a play caller. There have been a lot of prolific fantasy scores, running back, wide receiver, and quarterback under Trestman. So I think Brandon Marshall will fall in line with that, and I think the targets are still going to be there for him. And I guess by default, that makes Dez Bryant fifth, which is no big deal. You know, 1,300 yards, 12 touchdowns this season, third best receiver in fantasy football, and he did most of that in the second half of the year. Just imagine what he could do if he plays at that level for 16 games.
That's true. It seems like Dez Bryant finally seemed to put it together, the mental side of the game and the physicality he has. It seems like it finally fit together. One or two more here with Dave Richard of CBS Sports. One of the biggest surprises was wide receiver Cecil Shorts being productive in Jacksonville. I read some of your columns. I know he's a guy you like. My concern about him, of course, is the quarterback play, and across from him is Justin Blackmon. Do you think that Shorts is much more valuable than Blackmon, or will they end up washing themselves out?
I think they're both going to be good for fantasy. And first and foremost, nobody knows who's going to be throwing them the football in Jacksonville next year. I had a chance to talk for a few minutes with the new offensive coordinator in Jacksonville, Jed Fish, at the Senior Bowl, and he says there's going to be a competition there no matter what. So you can't pencil in Chad Henne. I sure as heck am not going to pencil in Blaine Gabbert. I don't want him to be the guy throwing to Cecil Shorts. But what we saw Shorts do, he played well, and And he did it in just a limited amount of time. There was a point during the year early on where he wasn't doing anything. He was just totally not on the radar. And then he broke out. And I really think that once he did that, fantasy owners were really interested in him. He had 9 games with double digits in fantasy points. 2 of them came early in the year, but they came on long catches. These numbers toward the end of his season before he got hurt, 11 catches or 11 fantasy points in back-to-back games, and then he had a 4-game stretch where he had at least 13 fantasy points in each and every game. To me, Cecil Shorts is a great talent, kind of like Victor Cruz. I'd like to see what he can do over 16 games in that big role for Jacksonville and with a better quarterback. And there's obviously going to be a change in offensive philosophy with Fish taking over there. And we saw Jed Fish do a good job at the University of Miami, coordinating an offense that had some good talent. He's going to lean on that great talent, and I think he's going to find Shorts as one of those guys who can help him deliver. And as for Justin Blackmon, we really saw him move ahead once he worked with Chad Henne. And he needed that cannon under center to get him the ball deep and get him in tight spaces on the seams, on the numbers. And I think that Blackmon is going to be a guy that you can draft in round 7, round 8, almost at the point where he was, I'd say probably in early August this year, as somebody, a speculative guy that you'll draft as your 3rd wide receiver, maybe your 4th, and he's got potential to start for you as a number 2 wide receiver. He's got good ability and good size, doesn't have great speed, doesn't have necessarily the height that you might expect from a top 5 overall draft pick, but I think Blackmon certainly stands out as somebody who can take the next step next year, especially after catching less than half of the targets that he actually had over the course of the season in Jacksonville. He had 132 targets and only caught 64 passes. That percentage has nowhere to go but up for him. So maybe you pencil him in for 70 catches. That should get him close to 1,000 yards. Throw a touchdown or two on top of that. That's a pretty good value for round 7.
Especially a guy as talented as Justin Blackmon, it wouldn't surprise anybody if he was able to put it together and have a big season. That was what made him a top 10, top 5 style pick coming out of Oklahoma State. Finally, maybe the biggest surprise in fantasy has been the emergence, just as in the NFL, over the past couple seasons of the tight end. The Patriots are teaching the entire league about how valuable tight ends are. Their number 1 tight end, or you could even call him 1A with Aaron Hernandez, I mean, they're both phenomenal, is Rob Gronkowski. He led all tight ends in touchdowns, but he has been hurt re-injuring the forearm in the playoffs. Are you concerned about Gronkowski's health, and are you concerned about the emergence of Hernandez cutting into what Gronkowski does?
No. And the number one reason why I'm not concerned about Hernandez cutting into what Gronkowski does is that they're not used the same way. Rob Gronkowski, more of a pure tight end. He can block. He can catch. He can do anything you want. He can spike a football into the ground, and it's stuck in the ground, and it can't move anywhere because he spikes it with such force. He's an amazing talent, and he's a guy that the Patriots are going to continue to lean on as a matchup nightmare for defenses. I don't think defensive coordinators still have a way to stop Rob Gronkowski. I think the only way they can do it is to, like, hammer away at his forearm and hope that they can crack it again, because he's broken it twice now this season. And that's something to watch, but I also think that he'll probably start playing with a brace on that thing. 79 targets this year, and he still caught 55 passes, 790 yards, and 11 touchdowns in basically, what did he end up having, about 12 games, I think,
yeah,
for Gronk. So, to me, that's just phenomenal production. Finishes the second best tight end in fantasy football. And I think you can probably get away, if you can get him in the 2nd round, you're on fire. But if you can get him toward the end of round 1, knowing that you've got a pick coming up in round 2, and you can use that pick to get a good running back, because there will be a good running back there, I don't have a problem doing that. I don't have a problem with you taking Rob Gronkowski. Say we're in a 12-team draft, Mike. If you get Rob Gronkowski at 11th overall, and then you come back and maybe you get DeMarco Murray in round 2. And granted, you're drafting 2 players with injury concerns, but there's also a lot of upside with them, and you'll just have to do a shrewd job of drafting the rest of the way. I don't have a problem with that. And certainly in PPR leagues, I think you're going to see that happen more often than not. Aaron Hernandez, he's a tight end in name only. He plays more like a wide receiver. The Patriots line him up all over the place. They like him as a wide receiver. They move him in the slot. They use him as an H-back. He's almost rarely an in-line blocker, if not ever an in-line blocker for the Patriots. So fantasy owners kind of get thrown a bone with Hernandez in that you can start him at tight end, but he's really more of a wide receiver. Yeah, if anything else, he's more of an offensive weapon that just happens to be at tight end. So you benefit from it. And although he didn't have a great season statistically because he missed a lot of time, 51 catches, 483 yards, 5 touchdowns, he's still somebody that I look at and say he's a top 5 talent, probably more of a top 3 talent at tight end. And I have no problem going after Aaron Hernandez and expecting him to play well, because he also missed a lot of time this year. And maybe there's a question about him staying healthy for 16 games for the Patriots. When he's on the field for them, typically he's going to get a lot of targets, and that includes in the red zone. And that's what fantasy football is all about. You want to have guys like that on your team.
Very good point. The Patriots often use the two tight end formations, and many of us can remember Aaron Hernandez being used also in New England, but as a part-time running back shovel pass for Tim Tebow when he was at Florida. He's very athletic. Finally, Dave, where can my listeners find your columns, your work, and where can they interact with you?
Well, let's start with our podcast, which we do during the off-season, all off-season long. CBSSports.com produces a fantasy football podcast once a week during the off-season where we answer everybody's emails. So, Mike, if you or anybody else out there has a question that they want to get answered about fantasy football, maybe a player that we didn't get to, they can hit me up on our podcast, and you can just find it on iTunes, search for CBS Fantasy Football, or even CBS Fantasy, and it'll come up. And it's me, Jamie Eisenberg, Adam Azer, occasional special guests along the way during the offseason, and then Nando DeFino during the regular season, where we all get in there, and we basically just chop it up for 45 minutes at a time, talking about the greatest game on earth, which is football. And then, of course, my columns, my offseason rankings, all sorts of in-depth stuff you can find at fantasynews.cbssports.com. And that's where you can find everything from rankings to projections to, you know, anything else that you want to find out about football. Stats from the season, you can search there for them. And, you know, we like to say that there is no off season, and that the best fantasy football owners are the ones who prepare year-round. And you can't just go to a grocery store and pick up a magazine on your way to your draft and expect to kill it. You've got to pay attention to football. You've got to step up your research, or you just lean on a site like CBSSports.com to do the research for you so that when you go into your draft, you can dominate and win your league.
That's true. Dave, you guys do a great job, and you are one of the best. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
I appreciate that, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Into First Down now, I am joined by Jim Deopolis, who spent 11 years as an NFL official, 12 years as the supervisor of officials, and is now the official consultant for NBC Sports. He also makes a weekly appearance on Pro Football Talk. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing great today, Mike. Great to be here.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for coming on the show. It is obviously Super Bowl week. There's a lot going on, and the sports world is always in a buzz over officials. The first thing I'd like to get your opinion on your take on would be the beginning of the season was marked by replacement officials, which clearly were not the best officials out there in the football landscape. First, how poor of a job did the replacement officials do? And do you think that hurts the league when people look back?
Well, it went into the season with the replacement officials, and the replacement officials were put into a very difficult situation. None of them really had the experience to work at the NFL level. These weren't even the top college officials that are out there. And so for that reason, the NFL had to hire officials that had very limited background, very limited training, and they tried to officiate NFL games, which basically caused an awful lot of problems. They just didn't have the expertise to handle game situations. They could work lower-level games, but they couldn't handle the intricacies of the NFL game. Did it have an effect on the game? Absolutely. It basically affected games every week. Whether it affected outcomes, that's hard to determine because the game is still determined by the players on the field. Officials always make calls, whether they're good or whether they're bad. They have some effect on the game, but very seldom do the officials actually have an effect on the outcome of the game.
I think the only game that you could maybe look to, or you can look to, and say the officials had a direct effect on the outcome of the game would be that Monday night game, week 2, between the Packers and Seahawks. But that was a very bizarre, unusual play with a lot of commotion. You make a very good point. It is a very difficult situation to put these replacement officials in. What is the big difference between the college game and the professional game in terms of officiating during the game? Is it just the speed of the game, separate from the rule changes, I mean? Is it the speed of the game that's the most difficult part to adapt to?
Absolutely, Mike. That's the big difference, is the speed of the game. In college, you will find athletes that have a lot of speed. You'll have linemen who are big. But in the NFL, everyone is big and fast, and the whole game moves a whole lot quicker. The most difficult thing for young officials coming into the NFL to realize is the speed of the game, and they have to get used to what goes on out there. And until they can get the game to slow down, the better officials can actually make the game slow down. So the game is played like in slow motion to them, so they can see what goes on. But that's the biggest issue right now, is the speed of the game.
We hear that with players all the time, especially with young quarterbacks that are used to making throws at the college level in windows that were bigger and tighter, and they always seem to say it's the speed of the game. And you could imagine these are some of the best athletes in the world, if not the best, running at full speed and full collisions. It's extremely difficult to make the correct call, separate from the fact that they have to dissect and figure out what just happened. Which brings me to this question. The NFL analysts always say that there could be, quote, holding called on every play. What is the difference between the on-the-books rule for holding, and what do officials actually let players get away with? Because no fan wants to see a flag every play.
That's a great question, Mike, and it was kind of interesting. Somebody asked me that yesterday as we were playing golf. He said to me, can't you call holding on every play? And I said, no, if there was holding on every play, first of all, the game would become boring. The fans wouldn't want to see it. But the officials are taught, they look for specifics when a player is being held. They basically put it into categories. They have a grab and restrict, a hook and restrict, a takedown. And these specific categories of holding have got to be observed by the official that makes that call. The other thing that they look for is this type of action to happen at a point of attack. So, for instance, if a runner is going off right tackle and there's a bit of a grab out on the left side, the officials are probably going to let that go if it has no effect on the game. So the actual verbiage of this holding on every play, sure, there's grabbing and there's grasping going on every play, but the actual foul does not occur on every play. You would hope that they would get the fouls that occur for holding, the ones that have an effect to give an advantage to a specific player.
Something that often I wonder about, or something that often many fans wonder about, is pass interference on defense. It seems that when there's a lot of pushing and shoving, unless it's egregious in the offense, they'll either let the play go or call defensive pass interference. What exactly is pass interference, speaking of the letter of the law?
Well, basically, Mike, what you're looking for as an official when you're looking for pass interference, again, you're looking for that advantage-disadvantage. You want to watch two players going for the ball. If both players are playing the ball, if both of them are looking for the ball and is hand contact, is bumping, is shoving, then you don't want a foul to occur. But again, as we have an offensive holding, we have categories that are put in that the official is to observe when he's making the call for pass interference. You have to look at it, and he'll say, "Hey, is he beat? Is the defender beat? Does he grab an arm? Is there an arm grab? Is there a hook and turn?" There are different categories, again, of pass interference that the official looks for. And again, he's looking for an advantage. And the other big thing that you got to remember is, number one, the pass has to be beyond the scrimmage line. And secondly, it has to be a catchable pass.
There's been a lot of news coming out this week that the player safety issue has been thrown in people's faces with the interview to come out with Rodney Harrison, Bernard Pollard's comments, the comments made by the president of the United States saying he wouldn't let his sons, if he had sons, play football. The NFL really has cracked down on player safety, but the game is inherently violent anyway. Oftentimes, it seems the officials err on the side of caution when throwing the flag. What exactly is the NFL looking at in terms of helmet-to-helmet contact that is incidental? And what's the difference between helmet-to-helmet contact that's incidental and helmet-to-helmet contact that's not?
It's very difficult during the game to determine incidental contact or unintentional helmet-to-helmet contact. What the league has told the officials is to that the verbiage, again, that they use is err on the side of safety. So if they see any helmet-to-helmet contact by a defender and a receiver, and again, this has to be a defenseless player, because you saw last week when Pollard ran into Ridley for the Patriots, that was vicious helmet-to-helmet contact, but it was legal, and it's legal in the NFL if you hit a player helmet-to-helmet. The players that you cannot hit are the defenseless players, and those are the players such as the quarterback, receivers coming across the middle, the punt return players before they've gotten their feet on the ground to make their return. But when the official looks at it, it doesn't matter if the receiver ducks to try to avoid the contact. If that helmet and helmet contact occurs, they're going to throw a flag. And even if they don't throw a flag, there's the potential for a fine by the league on that situation.
When we talk about defenseless players, I would think it would extend to players, not just including tackles. We saw in the AFC Championship game, Tom Brady slid and inadvertently kicked, or spiked maybe, Ed Reed in the thigh. What makes Ed Reed in that situation not defenseless? Because there's no way he would know or could anticipate a leg coming to kick him.
Well, you would consider Ed Reed defenseless in that situation, and that was perhaps a penalty. He probably, Brady should have got a penalty, a 10-yard penalty for tripping because he put his feet up in the air. But again, there wasn't any viciousness to the hit. There wasn't helmet contact on that hit. So again, that's not considered a personal foul. That's more of a foul that, you know, for a trip, which is a 10-yard penalty. And it should have been called. It's very seldom called on quarterbacks. He looked like he was trying to protect himself, but he did bring those spikes up a la Ty Cobb going at the second base.
It does seem that the NFL wants to protect the quarterbacks, and you can't blame them. Ratings are through the roof, and the quarterbacks are what ultimately drives teams in terms of success and viewership. Jim, we saw last week the Pro Bowl. It seemed to be more, even though the score is lopsided, there seemed to be more effort put into the Pro Bowl this past week than the previous two seasons. What do you think the league will do with the Pro Bowl moving forward?
In my opinion, they will keep this game going. Number one, the players want it. It generates a lot of revenue for the state of Hawaii. If you look at the numbers, the TV numbers, the viewership for the Pro Bowl was just about even with the World Series. So it's doing exactly what the league would like it to do. It's getting the viewers, it's getting them during the off week before the Pro Bowl, before the Super Bowl, and people are still excited about football. I've never been an advocate of having it the week before, but I understand why they have it the week before, and that's because of the fact it keeps the people's interest in the game.
That's true, and it's difficult. Football is so violent in terms of contact, and the injury rate is so much higher. I think probably the best all-star game in sports would be the baseball all-star game. But baseball, in terms of physicality and damage and demand of your body, is much different than that of football. A question that I've gotten from a lot of people that I've talked to regarding league rules was Justin Tucker, the kicker of the Ravens, in between the overtimes, he kicked a practice field goal that the Denver Broncos were not very enthusiastic about. Is that legal, or did the officials make a mistake there?
Well, I'm not sure if the word we can use legal, the legality of it. It's highly unusual. It's not allowed, but unfortunately, there's no penalty for it. It's not in the books as a foul. So what has to happen is if that kicker comes out and starts attempting kicks, then the officials are supposed to, get them off the field. They let them do that type of practice on the sideline, but they shouldn't be doing it out on the field. It was just one of those unusual situations. Back a number of years ago, there was the Patriots were trying a field goal, and they had a snowblower. They were trying to clean the field, and he kind of went out of his way to clean the place off. And I remember Coach Shula for the Dolphins went crazy because, you know, but there's no penalty for it. It's just not allowed, and then the teams are supposed to deal with it. But it was just one of those situations that occurred that the officials just didn't handle properly.
You worked in the league office. You know the way the NFL thinks. Is that something that they will change, or does that not happen enough so that a rule change is warranted?
I don't think they will deal with it as a rule change. I think they'll put some information in there. You know, they may fine the team, they may fine the kicker, but I don't think they're going to make it a penalty and go through the whole process for rule changes on that type of a situation.
That's probably true. It does not happen nearly at that much. A question a lot of people ask, Jim, is the tuck rule, obviously made famous by Tom Brady in that playoff game. We've seen very controversial calls, a call a couple of years ago, Ed Hockley, who is widely considered one of the best referees for my estimation, missed the call on Jay Cutler when he was with the Broncos, a fumble, he called it a tuck rule. What is the tuck rule? How do referees determine whether or not a pass is a fumble or an incomplete pass?
It's a very difficult call for a referee to make, because you have to understand the referee's 10 to 12 to 15 yards behind the quarterback, and he's kind of looking in there. As the quarterback comes forward, the rule states that any forward movement by the arm is considered a forward pass. And until that quarterback gets the ball into his body and secured into his body, then it's considered a tuck, and the ball is always going to be considered a forward pass, and it'll be an incompleted pass. It is such a difficult call to make that the officials are kind of told, treat it as a fumble. Treat it as a fumble as long as you can, and then replay could always reverse it. Because sometimes they don't get a good angle of it. Sometimes they can't see if the ball's being tucked in there because there are players, and it's 100% the referee's call. So it is a very, very difficult call. And it's a rule that's in there. It's been in there for a while. I know there's a lot of talk about changing it. But, you know, I've heard somebody say, well, let's go with if the arm is below the shoulder. Let me tell you, it's so difficult as that arm is coming forward. How is the referee supposed to determine if the arm is below the shoulder? Then it's going to have to be a replay decision. So I think the referees do a commendable job ruling on the tuck rule. I know a lot of the fans out in Oakland just don't feel it's the proper rule, but I'm telling you that it's in the rule book right now, and they've done a pretty good job with it. So I don't know what they're going to do with it. I know they talk about it every year, but they have not changed it as yet.
When the NFL decides to make a rule change, what is that process like? Fans every year, whenever a team gets the short end of a stick on a call, they always scream and hoot and holler that the rule needs to be changed. But clearly that process is a lot easier said than done. How does that come about? What is the whole process of changing a rule or adding a rule?
Well, anytime. I mean, you can recommend a rule change. You know, people can recommend rule changes to the competition committee. And basically what happens is all rule changes, whether they come from the fans, from the media, from coaches, from players, from general managers, from teams, all these rule changes are looked at by the competition committee. Then once they decide on some rules that are pertinent that they may think about, you know, changing, then what will happen is they'll put them together and then they'll basically present them to the owners. Once the competition committee determines that yes, this is a rule change that we should have. So then it has to go from the competition committee to the owners, and the owners ultimately are the ones that get to vote on whether the rules are changed.
Jim, back to on the field. When the playoffs come around, there is heightened emotion and heightened anticipation to play. Did the playoff games tend to be more difficult or easier to officiate?
Hey, great question. I would say the playoff games are a little bit easier to officiate. And the reason they're a little bit easier to officiate is because you're getting the best games right now, played by the best teams. You know, probably one of the great games to work in, and the game is so unique for officials to officiate are the championship games, because those are the games that have so much riding on them. Because the winners actually go to the Super Bowl. You know, granted, the Super Bowl is the ultimate game, but the championship game is such a big game. But each game, as the level of the game gets, moves up from the wild cards to the divisional, to the championship, to the Super Bowl, you know, I'm not sure if easier is the right word to use, but the players play a lot better as the level, as those games go on. When you get to the Super Bowl, no one wants to be the GOAT. No one wants to make that big mistake in front of the national audience on the Super Bowl. So they play the game a lot better at that level.
That's true. I've always thought that the best football weekend of the year was the championship games, because you do get four of the best teams. You get two games. Occasionally, the Super Bowl historically has been lopsided. Recently, the games have been closer. Jim, when you are in the Super Bowl as a referee, do you find it more difficult to let the players play, or is it because the emotions are running so high, do officials try to take control of the game and not allow them to get too far ahead of themselves? The players, I mean.
Well, you know, again, as I said, once you get to the Super Bowl, the players are going to be pretty much in control. They're not going to let the game get too out of whack. They work hard to get to that place, to get to that game, and they don't want to make a mistake that's going to embarrass them, the team, etc., at the Super Bowl. So teams play it pretty close to the best when they get to the Super Bowl.
Jim, this is a question I've always wondered, and I think you might enjoy it. It's a little less serious. When you were officiating, there must have been tremendous trash talk stories going back between players. Who was always a guy, or if you don't want to say his name, was there guys in the league that tended to be more entertaining to officiate their games than others? And is that something that you welcomed?
Well, to be quite honest, the most entertaining individual that I ever encountered in the NFL was Jerry Glanville, who was the coach for Houston, and was just a kick out there. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. I was an umpire. I worked with the interior line. There's a lot of trash talking that's going back and forth between the players, but it's not abusive. It's kind of, you know, it's stuff that it's kind of enjoyable to hear, and you know, I'm going to get you and you're going to get me type stuff. But the guys, there's an awful lot of respect for each individual out there. They all respect each other. It is a really violent game. They go after each other 150 miles an hour, you know, every play, every game. But there is utmost respect for each individual, but there is some trash talking that goes on out there.
I could imagine, especially, I mean, these guys are the best at what they do. We've all heard stories of athletes of all time going back and forth. I'm sure that must have been very entertaining to listen to. Jim, what are the final question, Jim, I'd like to ask you about. Sean Payton will be back with the New Orleans Saints as head coach. A lot of fans and media personalities have hammered Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, a little bit about his handling of the situation. It was an extremely difficult situation for the commissioner, the players, and the coaching staff to be in. It was obviously not what everyone would have liked. How do you think, from a league standpoint, the NFL dealt with that problem, the bounty gate, quote-unquote, issue?
Well, you know, not being involved in that aspect of the administration, Mike, you know, my feeling, you know, all I know is what I've read. You know, Roger Goodell is the head of the National Football League, and he has to implement any rules, any punishments that he deems as necessary. And from the information that he received, he made his decision, and he made his punishments, he made his suspensions, he did what he needed to do, which he thought was best for the NFL. And in my feeling, he did exactly what he needed to do.
I feel very similar. I think it's always better to maybe overreact a little bit than underreact, because the situation probably could only get worse. 9 times out of 10, situations don't get better as more information flows out. Jim, where can everyone find some of your information and find you out? Where can people follow you and see you on TV?
Well, Mike, normally on Mondays during the football season, I'm on Pro Football Talk with Mike Florio and Eric Casilius. It's 5:00 Eastern time. During NFL games, and I will be this Sunday, I will be on my Twitter account, which is @ReferreeJimD. and I will be answering questions. I will be making comments on the game. If any of your followers would like to kind of hook on, they can get me. Again, it's at Referee Jim D. If they have questions during the game, if they have questions about calls, if they have questions about situations that are going on, I will try to get to as many questions and answer as many as I can during the game this weekend.
I can tell all my listeners, Jim is one of the best, if not the best, at what he does. I am a follower as well. Jim, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Keep in touch.
That'll be the show for tonight. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you could find me on Twitter at FifthDownMike. The show is on iTunes. You can search my name, Michael Fiella, or the show name, The Fifth Down. You can also email the show, fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. Thanks for downloading us.